Much, Rob, for this introduction, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me and giving me the chance to speak to you. We've already heard quite a number of talks during this workshop discussing the relationship between classical probability theory and quantum theory, whether one is a special case of the other, or a generalization of the other, or maybe two distinct probability theories. So I presume that my introduction will be quite familiar to you, and I think I can go through it rather quickly, but don't hesitate to interrupt me if you have any questions. And maybe sort of some repetition might not be too bad after lunch, so get slowly back into thinking about physics. At first sight, classical probability and quantum theory seem to be two very different theories, in fact, because there are a number of phenomena in quantum theory that are unfamiliar and not known in the classical case. And we've seen many of these already in some of the previous talks. Interference, non-commutativity, uncertainty relations, entanglement, and the various hidden variables, no-go theorems. And I think, as for example, Rob and Philip explained very nicely in their introductions, one of several motivations for quantum reconstruction is to understand which of these distinctions are sort of genuinely quantum and which, on the other hand, are secondary in the sense that they can either be derived from the former or are more generic to a wider class of probabilistic theories and therefore do not single out quantum theory uniquely. But all these differences between the two theories notwithstanding, they also share a significant core of common properties. And I would like to spend the next few slides discussing what, in my view, are sort of the most important commonalities between classical probability theory and quantum theory. First of all, both theories have an underlying logical structure. They both deal with propositions about a physical system. What you see here in this table is a sort of comparison of the classical concept, the associated quantum analog, and the sort of generic language that I would like to use in the remainder of this talk. For example, what in the classical case corresponds to a subset of the sample space or an event in the quantum analog is a subspace of the Hilbert space. And generically, I will be talking about hypotheses or propositions. Most of these, I think, are very straightforward. Jointedness of subsets corresponds to orthogonality, or generically, that's a logical contradiction or mutual exclusion of hypotheses. Set inclusion is an embedding, which is a logical implication in the generic terms. Set complement, orthogonal complement, or just a complement. And finally, what in the classical case is the cardinality of an event or of a subset corresponds in the quantum case to the dimension of a subspace. And it's perhaps not such a common term. I didn't find any better, maybe have another suggestion. I will call this the granularity of a proposition. In mathematical terms, we just heard that in the talk before lunch, these properties then leads one to define an orthomodular poset. This is mathematically equivalent also to an orthoalgebra, or you can also formulate this or phrase this in terms of a test space. So there's sort of mutual one-to-one equivalences between these formulations. What I want to make clear at this point, and this is in line with Gerd Niestecke's talk before lunch, is that I do not introduce the Boolean AND or OR operations. They are defined in the quantum case only if and only if two propositions are jointly decidable. On these propositions, probabilities are defined. And what is, I think, important is that in both the classical and the quantum case, the sum rule and the Bayes rule hold, with an important restriction in the quantum case that I will discuss just in a minute. Why is this so important? It's important because in the Bayesian approach to probability, these two rules, sum rule and the Bayes rule, are really central to ensure the consistency of the whole approach, the consistency of reasoning about propositions in the face of uncertainty. So this is just a short recap. You know this from Chris's talk, of course. In Bayesian probability, probability is not viewed as a relative frequency, but it embodies some agent's degree of belief about a proposition. And therefore, it can be legitimately assigned also in instances where you have only individual systems or single events rather than sequences or ensembles. Now, the key consistency requirement is that if you have different ways of reasoning or arriving at a conclusion or at an action, then regardless of the specific path you take in your reasoning, you must always arrive at the same conclusion. That is this is somewhat different motivation from the Dutch book argument that Chris introduced. It's more in the spirit of the approach by Cox and later developed further by or popularized by James. One can show that this consistency requirement leads uniquely to these quantitative rules, the sum rule and the Bayes rule. And therefore, I find it very significant that these also hold, continue to hold in the quantum case, with the important caveat that this is only the case if the probabilities pertain to propositions that are jointly decidable.
Sir, doesn't that also for non-probabilities? Because if you have probabilities, propositions, conditions on different propositions, that you cannot, of course, just use the sum rule or the Bayes rule. So you need to say that the context of the probabilities must match in a particular way. So isn't that more or less the same?
The same
constraints. So that only probability, you can use those rules, only probabilities pertain to propositions which refer to the same context, which in the quantum case is they are jointly decided.
Yeah, if you take the view that sort of the quantumness is sort of a sign or an indication of contextuality, it's clear that if you have sort of for the Bayes rule and the sum rule to hold, you must have consistency in your conditioning. Okay, this is on the level of logical propositions and probabilities. And next, I would like to introduce a further commonality that requires an additional concept. And this is the concept of intervention by an agent. And the most generic setup that I imagine is a machine. So the agent can make use of a machine. It's a black box at this point. And the input to this machine is a physical system in a certain state, and possibly some classical information, an input register. Now, the agent provides the machine with an algorithm and tells the machine what to do with the system. Then the machine may possibly discard the system. So I allow for the possibility that that the system is not kept, but it's just thrown into the garbage, with some probability 1 minus p. And then with the other probability p, it's spit out, together again with some classical information, which is the output register. And an excerpt of this register, but not necessarily the entire register, is communicated by the machine back to the agent. I want to give you two very basic examples, and they only also just the two that I will use. The first example is a selection procedure. In that case, what the machine does is a sequence of measurements on the system. The register is nothing but a record of all the results for all these measurements. And then, and that's part of the algorithm, the machine is supplied with certain selection rules. And these may also be stochastic. They need not necessarily be deterministic. And then depending on these selection rules, the system is either kept or it's discarded. A second basic algorithm is what I would like to call an interrogation. An interrogation is, again, a sequence of measurements. It may also be an infinite sequence of measurements. It's, however, somewhat more general than in this first example, because I allow the measurements themselves to be stochastic, in the sense that the algorithm could say, with probability 1/2, perform this measurement, with probability 1/2, perform some other measurement. So the setup of the measurement is itself, or is allowed to be, stochastic. Again, the register is then the record of results. And a further generalization is that I allow, if this is a sequence of measurements, I allow the setup of a particular measurement to depend on the outcomes of the preceding measurements. This is a concept that's maybe familiar to some of you in the context of one-way quantum computing or measurement-based quantum computing, where a measurement is performed, the result is fed forward, and may determine the setup of the subsequent measurement. And this is clearly, and then the system is spit out. So there's no selection, there's no waste. With probability 1, the system comes out here. Now, regarding these two algorithms, there are some further commonalities between the classical and the quantum case. First, regarding the selection procedure. Here is, mathematically, the most general effect that selection can have on the state of the system. Let me walk you through this a little bit. Sigma, that's the prior. Okay. Now, if a measurement is performed, M, with outcome I, then, and X is an arbitrary proposition, so this is the given setup M and outcome I, this is the posterior probability for the proposition X to hold true. Now, generally, we do not have with certainty a specific outcome, but we have a whole probability distribution of outcomes, and this is the second factor here. Given the prior sigma, given the setup of the measurement M, we have a probability distribution for the various outcomes. So if you multiply with that. And now I want to, I'm interested in the state that comes out of the machine. So I know that the system has been selected. It has passed the selection rule. So I condition on the fact that the system has been selected. And in general, this may be also stochastic selection rule. So I multiply with yet another factor, which is the probability that a system is selected given the outcome I. And then I sum over all the outcomes, because the in this example, the results of the measurements, the record, is not communicated back to the agent. It's a black box, and the agent only sees whether the system comes out, so has been selected, or whether it has been thrown away.
There's no measurement on the right-hand side of the condition of the last expression. And so we also, sorry, with respect to the here, and we also expect the probability that we're in the sequence of measurements to appear in the front. On the left-hand side, you're not conditioning on the choice of measurements.
Yeah. It's, you're right. It's hidden in this curly S that stands for the selection algorithm, and the selection algorithm prescribes sequence of measurements, of measurement setups.
And what about the probability of given sequence of measurements? That expect measurements appear somewhere on the left of the condition when you're on the right hand side of this equation?
Well, in this example, the setup of the measurements is fixed.
So it's on the right of the condition on the left side of the equation. This is an implicit.
Yes.
The only sense is that how can the I appear in two places in the condition and in one place not in the condition?
Well, I distinguish between the setup of the measurement and the outcome of the measurement. So M is the setup, and I, that's just an index labeling the outcome of the measurement for the given setup. Right? So here, obviously, I need, in order to calculate posterior probability, I need to know both the setup and the outcome for that setup. Yeah? Here, I have given the setup, it's the probability that I have a certain outcome. Okay, and here I think that was Rob's question. The setups are implicit, but they are hidden in the symbol S, because S stands for the whole algorithm, so it prescribes the sequence of setups.
So the first two combined, that it's just the probability of X and the I given M. And
No. It's the probability of X given the I, given the X.
Two probabilities combined. If you multiply the first two probabilities, you have the probability of X and the I's given M and C.
Yeah.
The probability of the product.
Yeah. And
so
some.
So now, then the I's go in the condition, and then.
I think that the whole of that right hand side, when you tell me this is right, that it should be read as the probability of proposition X and the system is selected given that these measurements
are
performed with this selection algorithm.
Exactly. And if you then just factor it out, then you get this.
So sorry, that implies that the probability X conditional on includes, I mean, is also conditioned on the selection being positive, I mean, of it being selected.
Yeah, exactly. That's okay. It's conditional on having been selected.
So in other words, in general, I think you cannot have something like proposition of A and B multiplied given something multiplied by proposition of something else given B. It doesn't follow from any rules that I can see.
I think I can clarify. Combine the first and the third term and call it probability of X and S given I. Okay, the second term is probability of I given everything. Now, it just so happens that X and S are conditionally independent, given I.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Now, if you want to characterize this posterior distribution, then there are two ways of doing it. One way is to say, in this sequence of measurements, I characterize the last setup. Now, I introduce here a new collection. It's the collection of all measurement setups. It's in this logical language, it's the set of all decompositions of unity. I'm talking about von Neumann measurements here. Then this may be a discrete set. In the classical case, it is a discrete set. In the quantum case, this is a continuous manifold, and then it has a manifold dimension. Therefore, in order to specify the setup MN, you need this many real parameters. Then you can say, associated with each possible outcome of this last measurement in the sequence, you have sort of sub-distributions that have support only on the sort of subspace that corresponds to the specific outcome. Now, given the outcome I, and that corresponds to a subspace of dimension ki, then S is the number of parameters, sort of in Lucian's language, that would be the K, the number of parameters needed to specify the distribution that lives on that space of dimension ki. And you need to specify the sub-distributions for each outcome, so you sum over I. And the sum of these is the total number of parameters that you need in order to specify the right-hand side. Alternatively, you could have gone the direct route and said, well, on the left-hand side, I have a valid state that lives in a space of dimension sum of all ki. And in order to characterize that state, I need S as a function of this sum. So in order for there to be consistency, one needs equality here for the number of parameters. And indeed, classically, this is trivially satisfied because this is a discrete set. So the manifold dimension is zero. The number of parameters goes linearly with the dimension. And this is easily satisfied. In the quantum case, this is a non-trivial manifold with this manifold dimension. And as we've also seen this morning, the number of parameters here to characterize a distribution, non-normalized, goes as the square of the dimension. And again, this relation is satisfied. So what this tells us is that it goes two ways. First of all, it tells us that we are completely free to choose a stochastic selection rule. All selection rules are allowed. And in the other direction, it tells us that arbitrary posterior states can be prepared with the help of such a selection procedure.
Yeah.
Classical probability theory. You can also think about drawing colored balls from an urn and then selecting them or throwing them away.
But I can also think about having two urns. I must specify also for which urn. Then I don't think you can get that dimension to see. I think it's
in the well, if it's classical, it's always a discrete set.
Even in classical
physics. Unless you talk about, maybe I should have said this. I'm always restricting myself to the finite dimensional case here. If you go to continuum classical mechanics, then it may be different, but I'm always talking about the finite case here. So finite Hilbert space dimension in quantum case, or a finite sample space in the classical case.
With the comparing sample space, which is a fixed proposition with a space of experience, I don't see that much. So either you say, I speak about phase space and Hilbert space, then I can focus.
No, no, no.
If you speak about sample space and function space, I don't know.
I'm talking about.
It's a different category, so to speak.
I'm talking about sample space and Hilbert space. And the subset of the sample space, that's an event, classical event, in classical probability theory, corresponding to a subspace in Hilbert space. So this is my correspondence here. I don't have phase space anywhere.
But because. So Hilbert space is something to be described.
I'm talking about classical probability and quantum probability.
Classical physics.
Classical probability. I'm talking about classical probability theory.
But when you speak about quantum phenomena, you use classical probability because you speak about probability. So I don't see that. So you understand what I think? Maybe I can allow you to be happier with. He's comparing a simplex with like a dimension is the number of distinguishable states and the number of vertices. So it's more physics. So this is just, you know, the vertices are the elements in the sample space and the hypothesis space. I'm talking about possible probability theory for that versus the block hole with the number of distinguishable or any quantum space, convex set of quantum states. So the simplex represent a classical system, a physical system. Not
well, he's calling that classical probability. I think in Jürgen's view, there's something called classical probability. And you say there's only probability, but this is his fault. I know that you do. There's only probability theory, Lukowitz said. But Jürgen says there's classical probability theory, and then there is another mathematical structure. Okay.
Yeah, and I'm now at this moment I'm investigating their overlap between the two, commonalities between the two. Right? And the last statement was that both these theories allow state preparation with the help of selection machines. Next, I would like to turn to the interrogation algorithm. And I said the measurement setup can be somewhat more general in this case. What I have here, now this is sort of identical to the previous one, the prior. Now the capital I now, that's a shorthand for the sequence of measurement setups. So that was on the previous slide, it was the M1 to MN. And the R, that stands for the record of results, and that on the previous slide was the I1 to IN, the labels. So this is here, this is the same factor. But, and also this is the same. You have the probability of a certain of the outcome, collection of all the outcomes, given the interrogation algorithm, so the sequence of setups and the prior. But then this is new. The setup itself may be probabilistic, and it may depend on the record of results, so on the outcomes of preceding measurements. Now, the results may or may not be communicated to the agent. In the most general setup, some excerpt of the record is communicated to the agent. This excerpt, that is, I call that A. And then, hence here, you have to sum over the complement, so what is not communicated to the agent, in order to calculate the posterior probability distribution, the posterior state. Now, what conclusions can we draw from that? In case you have not required that anyway, this is a way of arguing that arbitrary mixtures of states should be allowed. Because if you say that you allow freedom in choosing these probabilities for your measurement setup, then automatically you can introduce mixing and you get the convexity of state space. That's a possible motivation in case you have not required that anyway. Now, so far for the some key commonalities. Now, the key question is, given this common core of commonalities, what are the additional assumptions that you have to add to that in order to get to the classical case on the one side and to the quantum case on the other side? And ideally, what you would want is just a single variable which, if it takes one value, it gives you the classical case, and if it takes another value, it gives you the quantum case. Now, more conventionally trained physicists might immediately say, oh, that's Planck's constant. But of course it's not, because we're not talking about any dynamics here. We're talking solely about probability theory, and there is no Planck's constant. Now, a clue what this might be is the following. I'd like to dwell a little bit more on this interrogation setup. And I would like to limit myself to the case where the interrogation is static, so there's no feed forward in the setup. It's also deterministic, so there's no sort of probabilism in the setup. But it's an interrogation that's completely hidden, so the results of the measurements are not communicated back to the agent. In this case, classically, interrogation has absolutely no effect on the agent's knowledge of the system. And hence, in the Bayesian view, where you say the state represents the agent's knowledge about the system, interrogation has no effect on the state. And this is intimately linked, and in fact, one can show this is actually one-to-one equivalent to the fact that all propositions in classical probability theory are taken to be jointly decidable. What happens in the quantum case is, in a way, the opposite extreme. Because even if the measurement results are not communicated back to the agent, if the setups are cleverly chosen, and you have infinitely many measurements, each infinitesimally rotated against the previous setup, then you can sort of manufacture a machine that will drag the system from any pure state to any other pure state. This is an old result. There's a slightly more general result that you can say for any two measurement setups, X and Y, both taken from the same collection M, and hence with the same resolution, the KI here, that's label M, these are the dimensionalities of the XI or YI, respectively. there exists an interrogation that basically drags one setup to the other setup, or in other words, emulates the probability distribution for one setup in terms of the other setup. And this possibility in quantum theory is intimately linked to the quantum Zeno effect. Now I'd like to take this as a clue for what follows. And I will allow myself now a slight digression on a more qualitative level and talk about what I mean by agent dependency here. In orthodox pre-Bayesian probability theory, there was not really room for an agent. Probabilities were relative frequencies or limits of relative frequencies. The data spoke for themselves and carried within them the conclusion that you could draw from them. After Bayes, it became explicit that you always had to account for an agent's prior expectation. And then Bayes' rule provides you with a rule how you should combine your prior expectation with subsequently accumulated measurement data to arrive at the posterior, which I call the conclusion. Now, quantum theory adds to this agent dependency yet another layer, because the answers, i.e. the measurement data that you obtain, they are elicited by measurements that you perform, by questions that you pose to the system. And in quantum theory, the questions affect the conclusions that you draw from your experiment. And this is a new quality of agent dependency. It goes beyond the agent dependency that's reflected in the prior. And there's a very beautiful metaphor by a person who's already been cited several times during this conference. And it's so beautiful that I would like to read it to you. It's by John Wheeler. It's taken from Law Without Law. And it's as follows. About the game of 20 questions. You recall how it goes. One of the after-dinner party sent out of the living room, the others agreeing on a word, the one fated to be questioner returning and starting his questions. Is it a living object? No. Is it here on Earth? Yes. So the questions go from respondent to respondent around the room until at length the word emerges. Victory if in 20 tries or less, otherwise defeat. Then comes the moment when we are forced to be sent from the room. We are locked out unbelievably long. On finally being readmitted, we find a smile on everyone's face, sign of a joke or a plot. We innocently start our questions. At first, the answers come quickly. Then each question begins to take longer in the answering. Strange when the answer itself is only a simple yes or no. At length, feeling hot on the trail, we ask, "Is the word cloud?" "Yes," comes the reply, and everyone bursts out laughing. When we were out of the room, they explain, they had agreed not to agree in advance on any word at all. Each one around the circle could respond yes or no as he pleased to whatever question we put to him. But however, however he replied, he had to have a word in mind compatible with his own reply and with all the replies that went before. No wonder some of those decisions between yes and no proved so hard. Now, what does this tell us? In this metaphor, the word does not already exist somewhere out there. Rather, information about the word, and these are Wheeler's own words, information about the word is brought into being through the questions raised. The answers given are perfectly consistent amongst themselves. And in fact, convergence to some word is eventually possible, happens. But the questioner has an influence on the outcome. A different sequence of questions will generally lead to a different word. And this is very much in spirit like in quantum theory, where, well, of course, not everybody will agree on this. But in Wheeler's reading, and I share that reading of quantum theory, there is no pre-existing reality that is merely revealed by measurement rather than influenced by the act of measurement. And the image of a physical system that emerges through repeated acts of measurement reflects as much the history of intervention and measurement as it reflects the external world. I find personally that this is a very beautiful illustration of this new kind of agent dependency in quantum theory. Now, if you take this point of view seriously, then this really means a radically different view of the world. Whereas in the classical case, you presume that there's some reality with an independent existence, independent of the observer, which you can observe without disturbing it, and which you can manipulate by grabbing it, cutting it into pieces, transforming it, etc. In the quantum case, you have the agent continuously interrogating the world around him. It's a continuous interrogation going on. Partly, the agent keeps a record of all the answers he gets, but partly, he also just interrogates the world without keeping track of the answers he gets. And sort of in this continuous interrogation then leads to the emergence of an image of reality in the agent's mind. Well, that's a bit philosophical, and I know certainly not everyone in the room will go along with that. But what I'd like to ask those who do not go along with this philosophical stance, nevertheless, to bear with me and to assume for the moment that this is really the distinguishing feature of quantum theory. So the question I want to ask is, and we saw this analogy already this morning in Lucien's talk, just as in special relativity, the mathematical apparatus of Lorentz transformations, which existed well before relativity, led to the discovery of the physical principle that space and time are not absolute, but rather observer dependent. However, causality, i.e. light cones, are preserved in all frames. And one can go backwards, one can also start from this physical principle and derive the whole mathematical apparatus. In the same fashion, what we are seeking to do in the business of reconstruction is starting from the well-known canonical framework of quantum theory. We want to arrive at an overarching physical principle. And here I would like to posit that the physical principle for quantum theory is that the image of reality is not absolute, but agent-dependent. However, consistency of reasoning is perfectly preserved for all agents. And the question is, can this serve as a useful foundational principle? And can one, from this principle, obtain back the mathematical apparatus of quantum theory? Now, of course, in order to do this, this first bullet here, this has to be expressed somehow in mathematical terms. And what I propose to do is what I, the last slide I showed you before this metaphorical philosophical excursion, was the mathematical effect of interrogation, where you saw that in the classical case, it has interrogation has no effect at all. Whereas in the quantum case, by mere interrogation, you can drag a system from any state to any other state. And I see that as sort of a maximum degree of observer dependency. Because by merely asking questions, the agent can transform the system in any state he wants. So that's going to be the mathematical expression of agent dependency. Yeah.
In the first column, the fact that space and time are not absolute is a matter of perspective. Space time is. In the second one, you were used to the word image of reality, gives the impression that different agents would have a different perspective of the system.
Well, different agents may arrive at different states. I mean, the image of reality is maybe too poetical a term.
So it's not a matter of perspective. It's, I mean, physically different or not.
Different agents who ask different questions.
The very same system.
Of the, well, if it's starting from the same system, or starting from two copies. Two agents asking different questions of the system will arrive at different states. Okay, now the question is, if we, sort of mathematically, we require maximum, I borrowed this term from Chris, malleability of theory, in the sense that we can drag it by mere interrogation from anywhere to anywhere. I mentioned earlier that this is closely related to the quantum Zeno effect. Now, the quantum Zeno effect, in turn, relies on the fact that the set of states is a smooth manifold, that there's a lot of smoothness in the theory. So if we want to explore the mathematical consequences of agent dependency, this leads us to the crucial requirement of smoothness. And this has two parts. First of all, the set of pure states should be a continuous manifold. It should also be, and that's something that Dan mentioned in his talk, it should be compact. And it should be simply connected. It's the hull of the convex set of all states. And you can only have convexity if the hull itself is simply connected. So that's the first part of smoothness. Second part of smoothness is that probabilities must change in a continuous fashion. In the following sense, suppose you start from a pure state E naught. And you have some proposition X that is true with certainty in E naught. The probability here is 1. Now you move the pure state away from E naught, and you have another state E. Then within some neighborhood of E naught, this probability, now X given E, must not discontinuously drop down to 0, but must vary in a continuous fashion. And this is the mathematical manifestation of this continuity requirement. Now, this has pretty far-reaching consequences.
kinetic theory statement. Because up to now, I've heard sort of proposition describing that. If I show that qualification theorem case.
That's something, yeah, that's something that I skipped. But it's I suppose that there's a one-to-one correspondence between pure states and most accurate, i.e. atomic propositions. And the pure state E is defined uniquely as the state in which the corresponding atomic proposition is true. Now, this has pretty far-reaching consequences. I'm not sure, given the time, whether I should go really in detail through the proofs. I'm very happy to explain it to any of you after the talk. So let me just show you the result. It imposes a constraint on the manifold dimension, or how the manifold dimension, the dimension of the manifold pure state, how that varies as a function of D, the dimensionality. It must be a linear relationship. And the idea of the proof is a very simple dimension counting exercise. It's a cartoon here to illustrate a bit the idea of the proof. This is the starting pure state E naught. This is X is the proposition that is true in E naught. And in fact, the line here is sort of represents the set of all pure states in which X is true. And then you have this neighborhood within which the continuity condition holds. And you have the new pure state E, which is moved away from E naught. And there is, one can show that there is a unique pure state F with the following property. Having started out with it in the pure state E, having subsequently measured X or ascertained the truth of X, then the system is in the new pure state F. Such an F exists, and then there also exists sort of a proposition Y that is orthogonal to X, and with the only exception, it has a one-dimensional intersection, which is just corresponds to the atomic proposition F. Yeah? And then you can look at the dimensions or granularities of the various propositions. And then you say there are two ways of characterizing the location of E on this manifold of pure states. One is, directly, straightforward, you say the manifold has dimension X of D. That's the manifold dimension. It's the number of the parameters you need to specify a point on that manifold. Alternatively, you can say, I say this X is like a base manifold, and Y is a fiber. And I first specify F, a position on the base. And then afterwards, I position E on the fiber. And then you add up the respective number of parameters that you need to match these. And this gives, together with initial conditions, this linear relationship for the manifold dimension. And now, what is the constraint that you get on the theory from this? And the mathematical tool that I would like to use is the symmetry group of my theory. I consider the group of all automorphisms that preserve of the logical structure, and hence also the its consequence, also the granularity. And I limit myself to what I call irreducible building blocks of the theory, in the sense that the group acts transitively on measurements. So I can, for any pair of measurements of the same resolution, so the same set of granularities, Ki, there always exists a transformation transforming one to the other. This immediately implies that this collection is a homogeneous space and can be written as a quotient of these groups. This down here is the stabilizer group. Okay, now let's see what this brings. First of all, the manifold of pure states, that's just a special case of such a collection corresponding to the granularities 1 and the complement d minus 1. So transitivity on n implies that the group is also transitive on the manifold of pure states. Secondly, we required that this manifold be continuous. Therefore, the group must also be continuous, must be a Lie group. Then we required that the manifold be compact and simply connected. This implies that the group is also compact. And it's a simple group up to an abelian factor. Finally, this isomorphism here also gives a relationship between the dimensions, between the manifold dimension of M, or specifically the manifold dimension of X, and the Lie group dimension of the symmetry group. This is this relationship here. Now, we had from the continuity considerations, we had a functional form, linear form for this dimension of X. Combine this with this matching conditions, and you get a constraint on the Lie group dimension, on how it varies with the dimension D. And you see it must have this quadratic, general quadratic form. Now, there are catalogs of simple compact Lie groups. And if you go through the catalog and see which groups satisfy this condition, then you find that at this point, you are left with the special orthogonal group, the unitary group, or the symplectic group, possibly with as argument, not just SOD, but any multiple of D, where N is an arbitrary natural number. But in any case, at this point, you've arrived at Hilbert space over some skew field, be it real, complex, or quaternionic. So indeed, it is possible to say the variable that brings us, that sort of moves us between the classical and the quantum case, that's agent dependency in the sense that I defined, with sort of the lower end with interrogations having no effect at all, corresponding to classical, and the upper end with the agent being able to really mold the system into any state by mere questioning, by mere interrogation. That's the opposite extreme corresponding to the quantum case. But there are two open questions, probably more, but two that I will still discuss in this talk, and then I'll finish. First one is, we still have sort of the skew field unspecified. Yeah, please.
Going back a little bit to that, the agent can move, can affect the state from any given initial state to any final one, provided the initial one is known.
Yes. True.
So you're interrogating a state that's already known.
On the other hand, this is This is the case when the interrogation is totally hidden, so you don't communicate any intermediate results to the agent. If you allow for communication of intermediate results, then it's quite easy. Then you can say, I don't know the state initially. I perform a measurement, I get the result, then I know the state. And then afterwards I do this procedure and I drag it any way I like.
But then you have some finite probability of failure. Yes. Whereas in the other case you'll succeed 100%.
No, that even then you succeed 100%. Because imagine I have a system whose state I do not know. Then I perform a most accurate measurement. Then I get any of the pure states.
Okay. Yes.
But whatever outcome I get, I can always drag it to where I want it to be.
Okay.
So one question we still have to answer is, what is the field of the Hilbert space? The second question is, could there be possibly intermediate cases in terms of agent dependency? Now, regarding the first, this is a question that has already been addressed by a number of speakers, and I hate being a bit repetitive, but I can also do it relatively quickly. There are two additional constraints that, in my language, I need to introduce in order to get it down to the complex numbers. First one is, so far we've only considered the machines acting on individual systems, but it should also be possible to compose them. And the requirement in particular is, if I have two distinct machines acting on two distinct physical systems, but now I allow the machines to communicate amongst themselves, so they can exchange registers. And I provide them with a combined algorithm that tells both machines how to act and also how to communicate, what to exchange. Then the net effect is a composite machine, a single composite machine, acting on the composite system. And the requirement is that sort of arbitrary compositions of such machines are allowed and give permitted procedures. Now, in the special instance of the interrogation algorithm, this implies, again, a dimensional constraint, namely that when you have sort of measurement with resolution ki in one system, resolution lj on the other system, and then ki lj, these are the resolutions for the composite measurement, then the manifold dimensions must satisfy this inequality in order to allow arbitrary combinations of interrogations. And just a sanity check, classically, well, these are discrete sets, so it's trivial. Quantum mechanically, you remember the expression for this dimension. If you insert it here, you see that it is satisfied. This requirement here, if you remember the general expression for the Lie group dimension, it had in front of the quadratic term, it had a parameter, which was the manifold of the dimension of the pure state manifold for dimension 2. Now, this condition here imposes this constraint on the manifold dimension. And this immediately rules out the quaternions. And it also rules out that in the argument of your group, you can have sort of a multiple greater than 1. So you are down to SOD and UD. And now, to eliminate the reals, that's an argument that we heard before from from Lucien, it's precisely the local tomography argument that if you know all composite probabilities or combined probabilities, then you know the global state. There's nothing genuinely holistic beyond that. This means that the number of parameters that specify the individual constituents and all their correlations, at least must be sufficient to specify the global state of the composite system. So this must be greater or equal, satisfied, even saturated in both the classical and the conventional quantum case, and that rules out the reals. Now this leaves me with the final question and the last slide of this talk, namely the question, could there be, in terms of degrees of age and dependency, could there be interesting intermediate cases between classical and quantum? And one candidate could be in the spirit of one of Rob's toy models, possibly, where you have a constrained classical, a classical theory endowed with an epistemic constraint, where the symmetry group, please correct me if that's wrong, but I would presume that the symmetry group would then be some subgroup of the full permutation group. And these toy models do exhibit quantum features, so I would expect that they would also exhibit some form of agent dependency, sort of understood mathematically the way I defined it, but probably not to the extreme that quantum theory does. Well, that's one possibility. Another possibility could be a semi-classical theory in the sense that I mentioned the group is only specified up to an abelian factor. And this abelian factor, since the group must be compact, that must be a power, some power of U1, the phase group. Now such a theory that has sort of such additional phase factors gives rise to the identical sample space and then identical logical structure, but with an additional phase attached to that. And I haven't explored the consequences of this, but it might be also something interesting to study. And finally, I'm very intrigued by Lucien's higher order theories, where his, I call it a mu, but you call it R, this you have sort of higher power in K as a function of N, what these mean. And such theories are not allowed when you impose this maximum agent dependency postulate. Because you remember there was, it leads clearly to ordinary quantum theory and doesn't leave room for these higher power theories. But if you look at immediate degrees of agent dependencies, then you also need not require this continuity property, and then perhaps these theories may sort of occupy an interesting position on this scale. So this is the end of my talk. Thank you very much, and happy to explain it.
You have a very complicated situation. And I have a calculus and a theory.
to calculate all the probabilities related to this, which I call probability or cluster probability. But of course, that's not what how you call it. So how do you call this theory, which I would use in this equation?
I mean, the scenario that you described to me sounds perfectly classical, so I would...
It's not, because it wouldn't fit there. Like here, you have, it depends on the order in which you make your measurements. You cannot consider jointly the probability of different propositions, because they can depend on different measurements. So it doesn't fit there, what you call classical in your...
Oh, it does. It's not quantum, but it's classical.
No, because you have this kind of dependence on which kind of measurement you do and in which order you do them, so which
in the quantum case. In the quantum case.
But this is not one. But you have this phenomenon.
I'm confused.
Don't assume really less propositions.
It's not really that, because so you have a set of propositions, the ones in which you are interested in calculating the probabilities. But they don't belong to the same condition. They belong to different measurements. So if you refer to the different measurements, each one from a Boolean analysis, but together they are a collection, but they have us a common ground. So this is not quantum, but it doesn't fit that one. And for me it's just probability, because I use the future probability calculus. So I just want a name for this.
You know, I think we have maybe a little bit of communication difficulty because we use different terminology.
Yes, exactly. So you call this, I would call this classical, but it's not classical because you call something a classical, which looks like the convective framework as a sequence, and this is not.
So classical for me is equivalent to saying all propositions can be jointly decided.
Exactly. In this case, you can. This is not true. So how do you call this theory, which I'm using on paper, to calculate all the probabilities I want?
And I would have to know your theory better in order to know how to call it.
It's just the ones with the sum rule, the base rule. I just use that one. I don't use anything more. So that's why I call it classical. But evidently it's not for you. So what thing should I give to this theory?
Does it give you that your question boiled down to asking for a name or something?
Yeah, maybe.
We'll let you up and think it over and maybe come back to it in the coffee break and then move on if that's right.
What's the agent? Sorry, what do you mean? Was a tangent being? How can you something around the nature?
It doesn't have to be a human being. I mean, James, for example, in his book, he likes to use the concept of a robot, sort of a rational robot, who is provided with data and then reasons rationally to arrive at its decision.
Okay, if you consider a measurement, somebody says a measurement correction, and the measurement happens, but nobody looks at the one the other point.
That would be in this case sort of a hidden, what I call the hidden interrogation. You program a machine. The machine performs the measurements for you, but doesn't communicate to you the results.
Then that happens. We need to justify the ritual. We need to justify the ritual.
A motivation for the convexity of the set of states. That's sort of one possibility to motivate that is to say, if I allow for stochastic measurement setups, so I tell my machine with probability 1/3 use this setup, with another 1/3 use that setup, and the final 1/3 use this setup. If I allow for arbitrary probability assignments for these setups, then necessarily I must have a convex state space to accommodate all the posteriors that will arise from these random decisions.
You had that time classical.
something in the middle, and it's one of the maximum.
I think there is something more than one corner, because, well, in, when you had the scene effect, it can create an illusion. In one case, you can also have a scene effect that stops it, which makes measurements on time. Could you have a super theory on your line that does not allow stopping an illusion fast? So, asking the question, has to create an illusion?
Well, I think as long as you require reproducibility of measurement outcomes, then you can always freeze the system in a state by continuously asking the same question, and it cannot move away.
Question about the quantum case. Is a comment, so you're asking about the domain-engineered type of agent dependence in subsets of classic theories, or subsets of inside, which for the case that I talked about, the season 2 and season 3, the answer is no. Because, as Bob put in his talk, the bases are all mutually biased. So it seems to me that a good criteria for whether you have this dragging feature is, can you have a greater probability of success at getting the state you want through dragging rather than, say, just doing that on a completely new state. Mm-hmm. And for any of these mutually biased theories, you know, if you compare a state and then you measure mutually biased bases, the probability of getting the state you want will be uniform. Mm-hmm. But there, I was talking to Bill earlier this week about how for higher P, you might actually be able to come up with theories where your bases aren't mutually biased. And for, say, D2-9, and in those theories, you might be able to have some kind of dragging effect because you would just have a random sample. But here's my question. If that were true, it's not clear that it is, but if it were true, would it not undermine your claim that this kind of dragging effect suggests that there's no pre-existing reality? Because, you know, there would be a great example of a case where there clearly one of the local models actually invert the model, and yet you had a kind of dragging effect.
Good question. I mean, the question is basically whether the maximum dragging is really equivalent one-to-one to saying there's no underlying reality. And I would have to think further about that. Don't know how to answer this question.
I haven't really understood the dragging property of the air sorry, but can you just go through the end of the so what is it that's different in the classical and quantum physics?
This is the key mathematical difference. In the classical case, so I is the interrogation algorithm, and we consider the case where sort of the results of the interrogation are not communicated back to the agent. In that case, an interrogation in the classical case doesn't change your knowledge of the system at all. It has no effect. You can drop the eye.
So for example, I have all the in one of four boxes. And then the test for example, every time I look at the same, so every time I perform it, I put the same box on, regardless of where it was before. So do I have that property in that case?
And you mean you have noise in the system?
Yeah, so that's the measurement. I don't know if measurement disturbs
Yeah, but then I think you have more than what I consider measurements here. So measurements are idealized here.
So they're meant to. So you're
Yeah, also, but I think that's something different still. I like these urn drawing examples. It's really a measurement is, I don't know, looking into the urn and counting the number of balls of different colors. Mm-hmm. So I really consider classical experiments that do not involve noise or any disturbance of the system.
And then that's because noise isn't an especially, disturbance isn't an especially non-classical concept when you can influence it classically. So, prior to that being a sort of unique constant feature, it seems to me then the work must be done by imposing.
But maybe then, okay, if we allow for that, then maybe different way of phrasing it, maybe more accurate, would be to say that if classically you start from a pure state, and then you do a measurement that may be noisy, the noise inevitably leads you to a mixed state.
So the example I gave you was disturbing, not noisy.
I have to give another example. If you have a classical electromagnetic field and you have polarizing lenses and you have a whole stack of them, a small angle that will reflect each other, the light that comes in with some polarization puts out with polarization twisted. And this is true of classical electromagnetic theory. We can forget about the quantum field. And it seems to me that this might be a type of measurement of this sort where you don't have noise added to it, but you end up with a pure state that is different. Maybe the polarization state is different from what you mean. I don't know if this is something that I'm going to have in mind.
Yes, that would be like when you always shift the units to the next box.
Yes. I mean, as regards to your example, I should say that I focused throughout the talk on the finite case.
Yeah, okay, so that's why I find why this is good. Because it's not like we have so many boxes that when you shift it to the next box.
Yeah, but then, I mean, the question is that still a measurement, or is it not rather sort of a more general transformation of measurement? It would not fit my more restrictive definition of a measurement.
Okay. But have you assumed at some point repeatability to be a definition of measurements? Because if you have a measurement that is described where you look for it in box one and you find it there, you move it to box two, that's clearly not a reproducible measurement.
Yeah. I haven't mentioned in my talk, but it is true that I do assume reproducibility.
Okay. So, I mean, one might object that reproducibility is sort of unfair to the quantum theory because rather than the steering. I'm still struggling to see what kind of steering the ability to be in on the customer. It's kind of a conjunction of steering and reproducibility of some customer, it seems.
Yeah, if you assume reproducibility, then it clearly rules out the classical. Okay.
Yeah, conjunction.
I mean, I think you also have reproducibility in the quantum case. If you perform the same measurement twice, write one after the other, you get the same outcome.
Yeah.
Alex, do you have a question?
Yeah, I did. This is just a kind of a question.
When you were thinking using the assumption of the room,
let's say the symmetries of the system, should I translate the spectral measurements of a fixed signature, a fixed color? You said as you did that, you were thinking about the building blocks, which I thought was an interesting comment. One of the motivations for making strong symmetry assumptions like transitive assumptions or irreducibility assumptions is with the view to then invoke some kind of decomposition theorem that says everything else is simply some kind of direct sum of such irreducible pieces or transitive pieces. Of course, that works in many, many contexts, but it's not a totally trivial thing. To see, or at least I couldn't think of, to see that there would be such a decomposition theory. I would say that every theory is often because of the sums of these things. Do you have such a decomposition theory?
I don't have one, and I think it would be a very interesting question to pursue.
It's reasonable to look at these things regardless, but before me,
exactly, that's a very good meaning.
So let me end with the last question. The other thing, 20 questions, is a lot of, like, Darwinian natural selection. Is that a thought ever moved you? Or?
Actually, no, but it's interesting. It is what it is. But where's the selection?
Well, the selection in the sense of the party game, you have an environment constituting that gets the party who randomly think of things and acts accordingly, which is like random changes in the environment of an organism. And so the refinement of the word.
I would sort of I would have this Darwinian association maybe more in relation to the selection machine rather than the interrogation machine.
Had the discussion of this, which is the so one thing that I think seems sort of not part of a future game in the distinction is that is what Alexa talked about this month actually, which is that in quantum mechanics it seems like after you've asked enough questions of a system, then the earlier answer is kind of irrelevant because you don't see the part.
Thank you.